This program is brought to you by Haymarket Books as part of the Socialism 2024 program. You can hear more recordings from the conference by subscribing to the Socialism Conference podcast feed. Many video recordings are also available at socialismconference.org. If you enjoy these recordings, you should join us at Socialism 2025, which will be held in Chicago next summer, July 3rd through the 6th, 2025. If you are ready to put ideas into action and get organized with others from across the country and the world, make a plan with your organization and your friends to come to the Socialism Conference.
All right, I think we can get started as the room is filling up. Thank you all for being here. My name is Ashiq Siddiq. I am one of the co-chairs of Democratic Socialists of America. And I'm very excited to moderate this panel. It's a very personal one for me. So we're talking about an eco-socialism that builds, what's next for the Green New Deal. And as we were putting together the panel description, so the panel description says 5 years ago, the Green New Deal transformed climate organizing. And it's actually 6 years ago that in 2018 that the Green New Deal kind of broke through to the popular consciousness in the United States. But just as we were thinking about this and talking about what we discussed for this hour and a half, just a lot of, it just feels like we've been really in a reflective mode, like everybody who's been involved in climate organizing, and just thinking about, you know, my own trajectory as an organizer. I started climate organizing in 2014, which is a decade ago. I joined DSA and started organizing through it in 2017 after a few years of climate organizing with the organizations, and really started to feel the limits of, you know, sort of nonprofit-based activism, and feeling like there was a lot missing in what we were advocating for and how we were advocating for it, and just the theory of change as we were, you know, becoming conscious of the climate crisis and realizing just how much needed to change, how quickly against the scale of the climate crisis. It's just really vast. And like 2014 was the year that Naomi Klein published her book called This Changes Everything, Climate Versus Capitalism, that I read that year as I was becoming politicized very quickly. So that really crystallized a lot of my thinking and understanding that, yeah, capitalism is the problem. It's the reason for the climate crisis and the reason that the most powerful industries of all time are able to, you know, have just total hegemony over our economy. I, along with many other people in the country, just were learning how we face the scale of that crisis. Now a decade later, we've been through a lot, like as a movement, and I use climate movement very expansively. The definition of that, I think, has changed a lot for those of us on the stage and many of you over the past decade. It's time to, you know, really take stock. Like, what have successes been? What have been the major setbacks? And there have been huge setbacks. We have to be real about that at this point. And for strategy, like, what has been working? What are the pathways ahead that feel viable when we still have no time to waste? Like, the urgency hasn't dissipated at all. It's only getting more intense. But our theory of change really has to be longer term now, as we have to really reckon with and grapple with what it takes to build the power to overcome this incredibly powerful and very entrenched system. So, there are a lot of ways that people are effectively confronting the climate crisis at scale while still advancing and realizing that it's actually crucial and core to how we do things. We have to center internationalism and racial justice and worker power. There are no shortcuts to achieving the world we want, the world we need, without organizing for those things through, like, those are what can make the other world possible that we know is possible and is necessary. So, when I was coming up as a climate organizer, like in those years, it was kind of a common mode to be like, oh, we have to tell our story. Like, it's really important that we tell our climate story and, like, have our, you know, we need to tell the truth. So I'll just, like, very briefly, I think, do that through introducing the panelists, because each of the folks here represents a crucial terrain of organizing and thinking about the climate crisis. And I also, like, have, like, personal relationships with a bunch of them that are feeling really resonant in this moment. And also just reflecting on being here at Socialism Conference, I was here last year where Naomi Klein gave a keynote address that was about her new book called Doppelganger that really is about grappling with this decade of organizing on the left through a period of Occupy Wall Street and the climate movement and Black Lives Matter and the Bernie presidential campaigns and all these big moments of uprising and, you know, rocking the political establishment and feeling like there was so much sense of possibility, and especially on climate terms, there was this real sense of urgency baked into that organizing. Like, we have to organize to change everything over this next decade, starting in 2020 when we could elect a socialist president in the United States. And all these things seemed possible, and then that didn't happen, and then the pandemic happened, and just so many hugely disorganizing things happened that stalled the momentum and just really made everybody have to reevaluate what we were doing and how we were doing it, and realizing, there really are no shortcuts to any of this. So in that moment of reflection, it just really, like, I remember Naomi speaking and giving this very moving, account for over half an hour, and just, I was sitting around comrades from DSA, many of whom had been doing eco-socialist organizing, and we had all come up over the past decade in the same way, and just, like, you know, some people started crying, and just, like, reflecting on that sense of loss and grief of, all the sense of possibility that it felt like we had, and just realizing, like, how long the struggle really has to be, and how deep the organizing really needs to be, and just feeling like, oh, okay, it feels like kind of some cobwebs are clearing up in our minds, like hearing it articulated this way, like reflecting backward on everything that happened and some of the real successes that have happened that we have to keep building on. I'll just start introducing the panelists on that note. So in 2017, I was living in Washington, D.C. I started organizing with DSA because it was an organization on the ground showing up to protest against Trump since the inauguration. And it felt like every weekend there was another big march on Washington for one cause or another, including a big climate march that had a lot of turnout. But through that period, a lot of us realized, including those of us, especially those of us who'd been doing climate organizing, like, we just knew we had to build something different from these, you know, liberal nonprofits that are doing a lot, organizing these big events, and also, you know, sort of the smaller, like, more radical activist groups that were, you know, still started to feel kind of self-selecting, like small groups of people who had a radical analysis, but it felt like we still weren't reaching all the people we needed to reach. So I was part of joining a coalition through DSA called DC Reinvest, and I met Johanna Bazua, who was organizing with 350 DC at the time. And I don't remember what you were doing professionally or whatever, but I just, like, remember you showing up and being a very sunny presence, and, like, but still, like, very rigorously helping us think about how we organize for a campaign to divest the city of DC from Wells Fargo and move funds into a public bank in solidarity with the water protectors at Standing Rock. Who'd been organizing against the Keystone Pipeline for the past year, which is a period where a lot of us were hugely activated by that movement and showing up in solidarity for it, but then starting to realize things like, part of why that stalled, like the efforts to stop the pipeline, is because there were labor unions, like major trade unions, who were supporting the pipeline. And actually, you know, we really need to reckon with that if we're gonna organized to change the entire energy economy. We need to build, like, a real just transition that is by and for the workers there. We also need to engage public institutions like city governments to transfer things. So anyway, I met Johanna through that, and I learned through working with her that she was actually a preeminent a scholar on public power. So it's just a great example of a scholar and also organizer whose work, whose critical research on how we build the alternative is grounded in real organizing experience. So we learned a lot that year through organizing. Theoria Francos is somebody who I also met through organizing in those 2 years from 2017 to 19 through DSA, through our local campaigns and a lot of chapters of figuring out how we build eco-socialism as we're developing that concept and learning about what a socialist alternative can be to, you know, liberal environmentalism. Thea was an organizer based in Providence, Rhode Island, who was pioneering a campaign for public power in Rhode Island, taking on National Grid. So there was a campaign called Nationalized Grid that was just about, like, how we take over the corporate utility to build a public alternative. So that was very inspiring. Like, most of us had never seen a public power campaign and still didn't really understand the energy economy. So Thea was just a really relentless but very, like, cheerful and motivating organizer. And, like, through doing that, I also learned, oh, wow, she's also a preeminent scholar on resource extraction and, you know, all these other things that, I, you know, she can talk about if she wants the next hour. And that became a model for a lot of chapters of DSA that were growing very quickly in those years to try out public power campaigns and you know figure out the limits of that, which we learned very quickly. Like there are hard limits to organizing if you don't have certain factors, which we could talk about, where public power campaigns have succeeded or built real momentum. There are certain things that had to happen, and we learned that from experience. So Brandon Mancia is the regional director of UAW 9A. UAW has just been like one of the most inspiring things, like to a lot of climate organizers, but also you know to the left in the United States, is just like one of the best examples of workers in a union organizing as rank and file workers to reform a pretty corrupt leadership establishment that had prevented a lot from happening for many decades, but through really relentless long-term organizing, reformed it from the inside, and then waged an extremely impressive contract campaign against the big three auto workers and won major demands, including things that are climate demands. They were really setting the terrain of the transition for the electric vehicle industry to be led by and for workers and center their demands. And also is creating space to agitate for things like a 32-hour work week, which is also a climate demand to shorten, you know, to limit the impacts on the environment, and also just make life better for workers in this country and around the world. And just on a personal note, so for the past, you know, 11 months now, obviously the genocide in Gaza has been ongoing and has been a core thing that DSA has been organizing around. I participated in an action back in December, or early December, a five-day hunger strike in D.C. in front of the White House. And day by day, there were just different kinds of actions and rallies happening around that. And on the fourth day, there had been a temporary pause in Israel bombing Gaza. And then on the fourth night of our action, they started bombing it again. And that was just a very bleak moment for everybody participating in that action. I just felt kind of like, okay, we were doing the symbolic protest, which we knew was symbolic, but the people here have platforms to, you know, amplify this demand after, you know, over a month of this happening. And it felt like a real moment of loss, like I remember very viscerally. But on the fifth day, we had planned a labor rally, where UAW 9A was like one of the regional unions that had already come out for a ceasefire, like one of the union locals that had been amplifying this demand. But Brandon was the one who announced at this rally that actually the entire international had just voted the previous night to come out for a ceasefire. And not only that, but they were also going to explore the possibility of a just transition from the military-industrial complex. Which is, for anybody who's been working on just transition or military-industrial things for decades, that's a huge breakthrough for a major union to come out not just for climate things, but also for divestment from the military-industrial complex, or even thinking about what that means. So that's just a huge deal and like really proof of like the theory of change that we've been building as socialists for what becomes possible. And last but not least, we have Elise Joshi, who is a youth organizer with Gen Z for Change. And we've had a bunch of great conversations about just the concept of youth in climate organizing. And I'll say, like, in the first years that we were doing climate organizing, that the Sunrise Movement was developing. And Sunrise, like, deserves a lot of credit for building that breakthrough in 2018 to popularize the Green New Deal. There was a lot of discussion internally about what youth means and like what is the definition of youth as you know like as an engine for change. And I just remember like year by year where we were talking about you know showing up for actions and like we need youth turnout. I kept being like, wait, am I still a youth? I'm like in my late 20s now. I'm like now 30. I'm past 30. And we just kept kind of like upward defining youth. So Elise has interesting things to say about like how they're dealing with this as Gen Zers now. Like I'm a millennial. So anyway, I'll just let each of the panelists start answering questions, and we can keep it conversational, or you can get as specific as you want. But the first question is the Green New Deal relevant now? And you know, like there's been a lot of discussion around messaging in the past 6 years about how the right wing has responded to Green New Deal, how liberals have kind of you know waffled on the framing. Like, how do we define it? As eco-socialists. So yeah, is the Green New Deal relevant now? And then what does it mean to be an eco-socialism that builds? So I'll let Lee start.
Hi, everyone. I just want to say thanks first for having me. I'm 22, and I feel like with that, I have so much to learn, and just being on this panel is very humbling, and I've just learned so much from socialism in the past few days, and I'm just really grateful. Yeah, I work at Gen Z for Change, and I would say at this moment, I'll be more positive later. The Green New Deal as a movement is not relevant to the masses. And as a result of that and many external influences, it's not really relevant to the people in power who would implement a Green New Deal hypothetically. I think that came, it was proof at the CNN interview with Kamala Harris, where she reversed her decision for the 10th time on fracking, and then also bragged about approving new oil and gas leases through the Inflation Reduction Act. So she's bragging about the worst parts of IRA in an interview. So, I mean, of course, we have to acknowledge that COVID-19 took a huge win out of the sails of the climate movement. But I also want to argue that the movement needs to evolve in addition to that. There's two perspectives that can be true at the same time. The Green New Deal was watered down to become the Inflation Reduction Act, and also the Green New Deal resolution doesn't mention fossil fuels in it. The Green New Deal is important. We do need public sector, working class mobilization to combat the climate crisis. And at the same time, this is our moment to course correct, to bring anti-imperialism into climate messaging in our climate organizing, to discuss the need to leave oil and gas in the ground but leave no worker behind, to stand in full solidarity with the Stop Cop City organizers who some definitely define themselves as climate organizers, but regardless of how they label themselves, they're fighting against the demolition of precious forest and against militarism. Additionally, it is our opportunity to have what Theo was describing yesterday as the element of surprise that I think the climate movement has really lacked in recent years. And to not, like, we're repeating the same tactics that our opposition is very familiar with and has repeated over and over again, and they know how to respond to. I can speak to Stop Willow as one example of creative tactical organizing that I was a part of. I made the first video on TikTok to get people to sign letters to the Biden administration to stop, to reject approval of the largest proposed oil drilling project in U.S. public lands. That's Willow. It eventually garnered full attention of the TikTok For You page and generated over 1.1 million letters to the Biden administration to stop the project. And it took the government, the Biden administration, by surprise. They truly did not understand how that happened, that, you know, creative messaging that was in full alignment with frontline organizers and indigenous communities, very creative digital tools could, you know, take over the internet in this way. And I mean, it was the first time since 2019 that climate was in the mainstream conversation. And it was proof in the polls. You know, after Willow was approved, youth support, 18 to 29-year-old support for Biden's climate and environmental policy dropped 13% from 48 to 35% approval. And so when that happened, the Biden administration was scared. I mean, Kamala Harris is now bragging about leases, so, you know, we still need to reflect, but clearly they were spooked by that. So, yes, we need diverse tactics, and we must expand our priorities to address militarism, big oil, and more. Another point I want to make before handing it off to other folks is that the youth that propelled Stop Willow haven't just withdrawn and backed out. We are organizing on our campuses, and to ignore the youth that are fully aware of the climate crisis and also organizing for divestment again from genocide and apartheid is to, you know, not address the full scope of where the climate movement is at. We're aware, we're just aware that this is a poly crisis in this moment. We're addressing climate change by divesting from weapons manufacturers. Instead of competing with Palestine for attention, I think the climate movement needs to do a far better job in working with and in full solidarity with Palestine and other movements, however we define climate movement. So with that, I'm excited for a resurgence of militant, creative, intersectional climate strategy. Eco-socialism that builds is one that understands that despite the urgency of climate change, we fail if we leave behind communities. And I know there's other folks that are going to speak to that as well.
Yeah, so the way I'm thinking about this question is from both a, you know, a labor perspective, but also a historical one, right? The original New Deal, right, was the historic compromise, right? At first, you know, it was in order to save capitalism, you know, the powers that be realized they had to reform it, restructure it, make it serve slightly different ends, right? Improve working conditions and material conditions for workers in order to prevent something else, you know, be that fascism, communism, et cetera, right? So under that assumption, right, and that mission, right, by the elite in this country and the FDR administration, what was propelling that was a fear of what labor could do, right? And I think the formulation of the Green New Deal and all its policies, and we can talk about, I guess, other speakers on this panel can speak more to the IRA and everything that happened under the first 2 years of the Biden administration. What was missing in our context was both a mass movement and a labor movement powerful enough to force that question onto capital, right? So it's almost a shame that I think that we couldn't see, this new UAW under those first 2 years of the Biden administration to see how much more that could have made a difference. But at the same time, what happened over the last few years, last couple of years in the UAW, is we were preparing for a contract fight, right, in 2023, where the question of the literal livelihoods and jobs of our membership were on the line, right? And by no means have we resolved the question. This is an ongoing struggle, right, against corporate greed and what exactly this new green economy is going to look like, whatever framework it's called. But that is the fight we took on, and we got started last year. So to me, whether or not the Green New Deal concept is still a historical analogy or something useful for, you know, the movement or activist organizers today and in the future, I think is less important than the actual politics of what we're building, right? Which is one that needs to center working class politics, the labor movement, and working class communities and all its complications and contradictions and everything that's messy about building that kind of politics. So, that's why I'm really excited to be on this panel to make sure we really tackle a lot of these questions and think of them together.
I'm so glad you brought up the New Deal and like sort of coalitional analogy. I'll talk about that a little later, but I want to circle back to that point about what coalitions mean and what it might look like in our moment to have a Green New Deal or whatever we call it coalition. But I want to start kind of somewhere else around this question of the Green New Deal. Is it a relevant concept? What does it mean today? And why are we talking about an eco-socialism that builds in the framing of this panel? I think a common criticism from liberals and centrists and the kind of rest of the political establishment of the Green New Deal when it first emerged in the 2018-2019 moment was that it would slow things down to make them so complicated. Like, we should just institute a carbon tax or, like, you know, figure out this one kind of market fix kind of policy and not add on things like worker empowerment and racial justice and healthcare and schools and transit and all these other issues. Those are just, like, unrelated, and we shouldn't mix things up because it'll just slow down climate action, right? Not at all confronting that none of that was the reason that climate action had been slow, the reason it had been fossil fuel lobbying, and all sorts of other reasons that we know actually hold back climate action. But I think that sometimes that puts us in a defensive position where we're like defending like why it's important, as Elise put it, to have an intersectional analysis and as Brandon put it, to have a sort of really broad coalition, right? We're kind of like defensive. And I want to kind of just flip that on its head a little bit, just as a kind of opening thought, which is that, you know, I think that basically the opposite is true. Like, the policies that we're advocating for and the communities and constituencies that those policies would bring along and lift up are the fastest, most urgent, and most rapid and holistic way to address the climate crisis, right? So if we look at something like transit, is it is it the fastest way that we're currently doing it, which is sort of to nudge and encourage individual households to maybe buy an EV at some point when their car like kicks the bucket and like is, you know, they're done using it, and maybe in 5 years they might buy an EV and they might get a rebate if the IRA is still on the book. Like, is that the fastest way to decarbonize transportation? Absolutely not. Not according to any climate modeler, not according to any urban planner, any transportation scholar would tell you the fastest way is to just get people out of cars. Like, even if the buses still use gas, like, you just radically reduce the carbon footprint by getting people out of cars, right? Or let's, you know, look at housing and buildings, which are such a major contributor with their heating and cooling systems and electricity to the climate crisis. Like, what's the fastest way to address that? Is it to, like, kind of maybe nudge the real estate industry to sort of accept, like, something that gives them a rebate if they maybe retro... Like, no, absolutely not. The fastest way would be to have, like, a public coordinated emphasis on green social housing and on forcing landlords and the real estate industry to, like, immediately retrofit things and making sure that workers benefit from that and unions are part of the story. And we can just look at, like, every single issue from the grid or transmission lines. Like, what would be faster for climate and is the same thing that in many cases would be better for social justice, which is, like, a public sector coordinated transition that is built through empowering working class communities that would be the ultimate beneficiaries of those green and clean services at the kind of end of the line. And so I think what ends up happening is that we're, you know, being told that we're slow because there's a confusion, in my view, between what might be politically expedient, like for mainstream climate policy or for, you know, establishment politics, and what the climate actually demands, right? And we should never let them claim that what might be politically expedient, you know, again, for kind of centrist politics or bipartisan coalition building is the same as what's fastest for confronting the climate crisis, right? And I think that, you know, I even sometimes get tricked by those things and feel defensive, but I just think we need to claim that, like, an eco-socialist approach, a Green New Deal approach, a worker-led approach, whatever we want to call it, and I think all of us are kind of agnostic as to the specific labels, would absolutely be faster than this, like, chaotic corporate-led transition, if we even want to call it that, because we're not actually transitioning away from fossil fuels right now, that is kind of currently on the table. So I think once we kind of clarify that, then the question is not, like, is it faster or slower to do an approach that is actually a holistic approach to the climate crisis? That would obviously be faster. The issue is that we don't currently have the political power to win things like green social housing or green mass transit or a publicly owned grid or the managed phase out of the fossil fuel sector. Like, we don't have that power right now. We have it in pockets and places, and some of those areas have seen victories, but on the sort of national scale, let alone kind of an international scale, obviously those things aren't happening at the speed and kind of scope that's necessary. The question, I think, is just one of the lack of power, not one that, like, our policies or our frameworks or our coalitional kind of strategies are what are slowing things down.
The great thing about being the last person to speak on this is that I get to say plus one to everything that has been said. But truly, I think what I feel like the panelists here have already said is that we're in the process of remaking what the Green New Deal means to us in this moment, because we are in a very different context from the one we were previously, and we've learned a lot in that process, right? And, you know, I think the moment of having the Green New Deal really did, it opened up possibility in the climate movement. It took a lot of what was talked about in molecules and made it, like, very visceral. It made it someone's lives. It made it their home. And that's, like, the piece that I think, regardless, is the piece that really activated a base in a way that we hadn't seen before, and also gives us so many more opportunities to think across those intersections. So I think that's the activating force that we can continue to bring into whatever comes next, whatever it may be called. And thinking about this, like, question of eco-socialism that builds, I mean, part of the reason we bring this up, and I'll maybe talk about it in a second, is that there's been this idea of liberalism that builds. Like, we just need to get these silly regulations out of the way, and then we'll be able to fix the crisis. And I think what we're saying is, no, we actually do need to build the power of the labor movement, the power of young people, the power of, you know, tenants, and that is actually going to ultimately get us to where we need to be. And that means also framing framing the work that we do in ways that we're actually telling the story of how we're making people's lives better. Often at Climate and Community Project, we say that we need climate policy that you can touch, you can feel, you can see, you can live in that house that is better than now than what it was before. And that's actually not, you know, if we think of the Green New Deal being whittled down and whittled down and whittled down into what we ultimately got 2 years ago now of the Inflation Reduction Act, we didn't get climate policy you can touch. What we got were itty-bitty little subsidies that, like, you can maybe get if you are, you know, have over $100,000. And, you know, just an example of that, for instance, like, let's say, yeah, I live in Maine, so this is a place where energy efficiency is a really big problem for people being able to stay warm, like, pay their bills. And, like, there are subsidies to switch out your windows in the Inflation Reduction Act, but it's capped at $800. That's what you can have for your house, right? A window costs $500, and, like, hopefully you have more than one window in your house, right? And so if we're actually thinking about giving people the things that they need in order to transition and transform, it needs to be more than a window. And, like, if we can't even pay for a window, what the hell are we doing here? Like, that's why we need to be thinking about those, like, green social housing things on the scale in which it's actually going to build on the timeline that we do in fact need. And I think Thea just makes such a good and concrete point. Like, green social housing is the answer. It is not, you know, just making sure a rich kid can have, you know, solar nicely and aesthetically on the top of their house. And the other piece here, I think, that is eco-socialism that builds is the management. Like, we are of the transition, right? Like, this is not easy stuff we're talking about doing. Like, we have to fully remake an energy system. Like, that's really hard to do, and there are so many opportunities for that to be maladapted, for it to, like, really mess up, like, how our energy system works. And if we're winding down fossil fuels, and, like, how are we going to actually be able to accomplish that if we don't plan it? I mean, the fossil fuel industry is not about to shut itself down. I can confirm, like, it, if you've seen any of the activism as of late, like, they are going down kicking and screaming. And that's why we actually do need state intervention into these places and say that we are actually taking control of this. And that means that we are going to take care of people through that process. And that's not what's being done right now in terms of, like, the neoliberal affect towards, like, these kind of climate issues and, you know, how we've seen Biden and Bidenomics play out. So yeah, maybe I'll keep it there, because I think the two things that we need to make people's lives better, and we need to plan the transition.
Awesome. Thank you all. I'll just briefly answer my own question a bit from the DSA eco-socialist perspective. So since 2017, we went through a whole, like, years-long process of trying to define, like, what are our eco-socialist principles for a Green New Deal? Like, understanding that even if, you know, the whole program AOC laid out in 2018 were accepted by Democrats and, you know, by a president like Bernie Sanders, or maybe pressuring somebody like Biden, the march through the institutions would totally just water it down and make it the most liberal compromised version of it. So as socialists, what do we want? Mm-hmm. So we talked to a lot of our own members about it, and just very clearly things came out like, okay, public power, public ownership, worker ownership, just internationalism. These things need to be baked in. And then, okay, now that we have this great set of principles that has a lot of consensus within our organization, how do we organize for it? So especially after 2020, when it became clear that at the federal level of government, just the avenues are closed after the whole Build Back Better situation happened, and there were a lot of efforts to organize around it, and we got what we got. But then we really decided to focus on supporting our chapters to organize at the state and local level for municipal or state level campaigns. And a few things quickly emerged as the ones that felt viable. One are public power campaigns with certain conditions and, you know, criteria that we learned about through experience about what makes those viable. Public transit campaigns, green social housing for public and collective housing, and then green public spaces. Like, these are things that just demonstrate clear value to working class people. And if you can organize to win them and organize a lot of people into the coalitions to win them, then that just raises expectations and helps people organize for and win more. So if anyone's interested, you can check out ecosocialist.dsausa.org and check out the Building for Power campaigns. So there's a lot more we could say about that. But then, Getting to the next question, how do the timelines of the climate crisis affect our political calculations? And this is something that just, you know, just like coming into it from the outset, like the climate organization I started with was about like, we need to get to zero emissions and change everything in a decade, like 2030 is the 2025 we were talking about at the time. Like, we're gonna get to zero emissions by 2025. And now that's next year, oh my God. So yeah, we just had to keep going through this adjustment of like, okay, well, we're not winning the things that we would need to get to change everything in a decade. So it just kept changing to 2030 and then 2035. And now I feel like we're not even real. Yeah, so how do you answer that question? How do the timelines affect our political calculations now?
Yeah, I think that's it's interesting. I'm just thinking about this time I was running when I lived in D.C. With Ashika. We were both in D.C. at the same time. And I ran across a trail in Rock Creek Park. And the sign said, it was like, you know, Department of Public Works, this trail will be open again in 2027. And I was like, shit. Like, we are supposed to have, like, basically fully decarbonized the entire, like, worldwide economy by then. But, like, my community trail is not going to be open. And I think, like, I say that because, like, timelines can be really debilitating. They can feel debilitating. And also, they can be opportunities for pressure and for action. And in its best form, right, it compels the, like, a government to act. It forces them to look and actually try to discern how they are going to meet targets by certain dates. But on the other hand, sometimes, and we have definitely seen this in the climate movement, that pressure of a timeline also creates terrible compromises. And I think that's always like the piece that we are holding as climate organizers and activists is like, how do we hold both these things at once? And you know, to just talk a little bit about timelines, as I described, like, I don't love always talking in molecules or like dates, but to mention some that I think many of you already know. It's, you know, 2015. So it was 2015, now, you know, almost 10 years ago that the Paris Agreement was signed. We said we wanted at that point that they were countries were committing to 2 degrees with an intent to get to 1.5. And then in 2018, the Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change actually interrogated what does it mean to get to 1.5. So this is an example of like that pressure is helpful, right? They had to go through and actually ask the question of what does a 1.5 versus 2 degree world look like? And it's radically different. It is, in fact, the difference between, you know, massive amount swaths of the global south living in poverty versus not, right? And like, I think the difference between 1.5 and 2 degrees is like, you could have 50% more water, you know, potable water. It's huge, it's huge differences. And right now we've actually surpassed 1.5 degrees for the first time this year. That doesn't mean it's irreversible, but it is a truth that we're now living with. So I think the thing when it comes to timelines and like these numbers is that we can use them for organizing, but they also can feel really heavy. And but I think the thing that's really important to remember is like every little bit, like everything that we can stop is better than the like 0.002 degrees. So I think like we can't think that like once we hit that 1.5 like we did this year, that that's the end. Like that's the end of our struggle and like get into a fatalist orientation. And you know, I think this is the core question when it comes to like the liberals and libs that are organizing around climate versus I think ourselves as eco-socialists is they have made in some ways a calculation that we don't have time to transform the world. We, in fact, the fastest way, as Theo was describing before, the fastest way forward is to work and operate within the systems that we have. And please tell me how that's going to work, since those are the systems that, in fact, created the climate crisis. And so, but we are, you know, we may not be able to, like, fully solve, you know, capitalism by, like, the, and, like, get to eco-socialism in, like, the next 3 to 4 years, but we can identify those non-reformist reforms that actually set us up to build toward the power that we need in order to get to that alternative vision. And I think it is figuring out how we build with labor movements, how do we support as comrades of the UAW to actually build that type of power so that they are ready to do a general strike and that we are in solidarity. You know, those are the types of things that, like, they do take time and it's worth it, because we will have created far better conditions even in that warmed world. So maybe I'll stop there. Well, actually, no, I'm gonna go one more place. Because it has occupied my mind so deeply in the past 2 years. There is, so the Inflation Reduction Act passed. You know, yes, as we've talked about, not perfect. It's a bit of climate. We can work with what we've got there, right? We'll organize for the parts that are good, and we'll learn from what happened. But one of the things that was in here was Manchin, Senator Manchin from West Virginia, had this side deal called, you know, I would like to call it the dirty deal, many do, but it was this a deal about permitting, and this gets to the liberalism that builds peace, right? It's, you know, often described like, well, you know, if we need to get as much transmission into the ground, we need to get as much solar on, you know, out there as possible, we need to get rid of these nasty environmental regulations that are just slowing us down. We shouldn't have to, you know, like talk to communities and, like, you know, do these, you know, deep dives into the environmental implications of a solar plant, because it's more important that the solar plant is there. And so what's happened there is, like, actually the fossil fuel companies have used this against us. And so now they've actually integrated for these permitting deals, it's actually like fast-tracking permitting for renewables, but also for fossil fuels. And many are actually saying that's a compromise that they are willing to make, because it matters more to get the renewables in the ground and, like, we'll deal with the fossil fuels later. But as we've talked about, we need to do a managed transition. We need to be able to do both of these things at once. And we're actually instead expanding both at the same time without the community engagement that's actually necessary to build the power that we need. And in fact, I think when we look at that liberalism that builds, like, that, you know, elimination of bedrock environmental laws, what and we think about the relationship, particularly where this stuff is going, it's often in more rural areas. And of course, we have seen the disinvestment. We have seen, you know, that, like, this disinvestment in rural areas has also been connected to a turn to the right and to fascism. And if we say that our plan as the left is to just bowl over those people again, I think what we can actually see is an acceleration. And that is going to hurt and harm us when it comes to, you know, actually achieving the bigger goals that we have in mind. And I think that's the short-sightedness of some of these folks that are thinking about permitting in that way. Okay, now I'm actually going to stop.
I'll just say something brief, because I think you kind of covered most of what I was also thinking. I think one of the key tensions of the, and this is obvious to say, but I'll just say it out loud, like, one of the key tensions of the urgency of the climate crisis is that left-wing organizing, especially from, like, a base-building perspective, takes a lot of time, right? Like, so if we want to do rank-and-file organizing, right, we want to, like, engage, like, you know, shop floor workers in the process of democratizing their unions and, like, running for leadership positions and doing more militant strike tactics, so that would be in the labor arena. We want to organize tenant unions. That's knocking one door at a time and creating relationships that might take a year to really, like, fully solidify. If we want to engage transit users in really dilapidated transit systems into, like, actually becoming part of riders' unions that then might run for, like, planning councils that then they can make decisions about land use policy, like, these are years and years long, decades long struggles that, like, at least half of this room of folks of faces I know well or kind of somewhat recognize, like, are involved in, right? And, like, it takes time. It's not easy to actually organize and empower working class people that have been told for a long time that they're not leaders, that they have no voice in the political system, and may lack the kind of confidence like to even like get involved, right? So even getting people involved in these processes to begin with is challenging. So base building takes time. And that's just like one of the things we need to do. There's other stuff, and to some of Johanna's point, not in the civil society space, but like in government that we need to do. Like we need the public sector to actually have the administrative capacities, the resources, the technical expertise, hopefully in ways that are aligned with our politics. But even if like on a more neutral technical level, if that exists, like we literally don't have that stuff in the administrative state because Republicans, with obviously accomplices in the Democratic Party, have basically destroyed the administrative state and like public sector capacities, right? So you can go to the municipal level, the state level, the federal level, and we just don't the resources or capacities to do the things that Johanna was saying, like to plan the transition, to buy out stranded assets of fossil fuel companies, to actually figure out where renewable energy could be sited in ways that doesn't like ruffle the community's feathers and actually engages them and protects landscapes. Even just economic planning is a skill that we basically lost since like World War II, which was the last time that the U.S. had like a major initiative of economic planning, right? So all of those capacities, whether in quote civil society or in the state or among like workers, like take a very long time to build, and we just simply don't have time, right? So I think that's a real contradiction that we need to grapple with, and there's not really a way, I don't think, to like resolve that contradiction. I think it just is a tension of our work. But I will say, and just coming back to something Johanna was saying and something Brandon was saying earlier, that it's extremely important to ensure that we are in that long time horizon that will exceed our lives on this planet of building the capacities to create an eco-socialist society, that we are gaining material gains that are visible, that are more short and medium term, and that are immediately like materially beneficial to working class people, which the Inflation Reduction Act hasn't done. It's not even, and I don't know that I would name that as even my primary critique of it, because I have a bunch of critiques of it, but it's primarily created material gains for affluent people. And those are people that, you know, on the whole, you know, they're not actually who we need to organize, especially as socialists, right? And so if the fact that, you know, ordinary people are not seeing any gains from like what's been like branded as the biggest climate legislation ever in the US, which it is, sadly, then they're not going to see themselves in climate policy, right? So how do we, you know, with also some of the campaigns that Ashik mentioned around like public power, transit, housing, green spaces, around the union organizing that Brandon was saying, like ensure that the base building and the long durée struggles we're involved in, like have moments where there's like really concrete material victories that people can claim as their own, and also like when they go home to their, you know, green, publicly green retrofitted house, like they like actually live in that victory, right? It's not just like, oh, I won that thing or I won it for someone else, but I'm actually living in the world that I created. And kind of having those two temporalities intersect in a kind of mutually beneficial feedback way, I think that's the like, that's the trick or the magic of like when this approach works the best. But I think we do have to acknowledge that there's a fundamental tension with how long it takes to organize a fundamentally disorganized working class and what the climate timeline demands of us.
Thank you. And yeah, go ahead. Okay. Brandon, if you want to just briefly say something about UAW's timeline toward 2028, that feels very relevant and kind of flipping, you know, like versus like this needs to happen for climate reasons versus this needs to happen for our organizing.
Well, I think, you know, the two previous speakers are absolutely right about everything they said, and yet things can change very quickly. And that's what we have to keep in mind as well. Just to keep using our example, you know, our union is not the union it is today. It wasn't our union 2 years ago, right? 4 years ago. Things can change rapidly. It doesn't mean everything has changed. It doesn't mean everything has improved. It doesn't even mean that the contracts we won are the best contracts that we have ever signed in the UAW. It just means that the terrain of struggle changes very rapidly. So the most important thing to build, you know, as organizers is the capacity amongst, you know, rank and file members to build their leadership power, right? It means winning concrete gains along the way, right? Even if it means, if it feels small or medium compared to the large tasks ahead of us. And it also just means being prepared, right? So advancing those ideas, advancing those solutions, advancing, you know, really broad, ambitious campaigns. campaigns. And that's what 2028 is all about, right? 2028 is not just a strike so that we can win our next record contract. 2028 is a demand that the working class in this country and in this world deserve better, right? And deserve the power to be able to change, fundamentally change their society and remake their society to benefit working class communities and working class people. So I think climate demands need to be at the center of that, right? Because as all of the speakers here very likely agree, everything, you know, that we talk about in terms of climate policy or climate politics touch every single other aspect of society, right? So if we want, you know, child care and elder care in this country to be universal and free, right? If we want to be able to, you know, reinvest in our communities, right? If we want to change industrial policy, if we want to change housing policy, you know, we need to make sustainable pro-worker, you know, advanced pro-worker policies and movements. And so the timeline question to me, yes, it is dire. It is, you know, it's an emergency. Right, but that also means that through all of our work, being prepared for those moments that open up for us to take power is super important. Thank you.
I wanted to reference a book that I just finished, Burnout by Hannah Proctor, just came out this year, and she makes a really good point that separating our larger vision into smaller chunks and achieving them in various ways, tactically and messaging-wise, is different than defining the movement by the pieces easiest to solve. And right now, VCs, the auto industry, big oil, are trying to define it in the ways that benefit them, in the ways that are easiest. And as Johanna mentioned, in ways that actually are a detriment to the other efforts, i.e. permitting and attacking regulation and community input. And so with that, as people who want to push back on it, we need to have that larger vision. You know, dividing it up into smaller chunks means having an idea of the whole. And that was what the Green New Deal is. And whatever we redefine it as, we need to be on the same page of. And with that, we can coordinate and communicate with each other on what are the mechanisms we are going to use to enact that change in a way that doesn't that doesn't hurt another person's effort, another group's effort. And yeah, I just wanted to add that piece, but everybody, what everybody said, ditto.
Thank you. And I would just add, as a segue into the next question, that just the question of thinking about timelines and like the experience of these past years have really emphasized the lesson that there are no shortcuts. And that's an important lesson from the great labor organizer Jane McAlevey, who passed away, whose work was really critical to us building DSA over the past decade, but especially eco-socialists. She wrote a lot and framed a lot of her interventions around labor organizing in terms of things like, how do we build an environmental movement that is ready to win huge things, which was a core concern of hers. And as a labor organizer, she just laid out a lot of her disillusionment of a lot of failures of labor organizing for the past two decades, and how the lessons that she synthesized could also apply to movements like environmentalism for building a real climate movement that's ready to win huge things, because it uses like lessons from successful labor organizing. So that's been really grounding, like to the point Johanna made, like we have to grapple with the urgency of everything, but realizing like we can't take shortcuts. We have to go through building our alternative power, especially through labor. So on that note, the next question is, what does it mean to build winning political coalitions? And what kinds of double binds do we find ourselves within as a climate left? So I'll go to Thea for that one.
So this is where I'm going to come back to what Brandon was saying earlier about the New Deal Coalition. So I'm really glad that you brought up that historical example, because, you know, there are a lot of ways to talk about coalitions, like on the left, right? And I think when we think about coalitions on the left, we think about, like, what are our allied groups? Sometimes people don't like the alliance language or ally language. Okay, what groups are we in solidarity with? Like, who are we at a table with and kind of struggling towards a common end with an idea that we all mutually benefit or all have stakes in this or our fates are entangled together in some way, right? And that's one way to think about a coalition, and I think it's a powerful one, and I'll sort of come back to that in a moment. But I want to think more almost on the level of, like, just formal political change or change in the political system, which is why I think the New Deal example, which was not our coalition, meaning if we go back to the New Deal, we would pretend that we were around in the 1930s, and like, would we as socialists have seen ourselves in the entirety of the New Deal coalition? No, there were literally like large-scale manufacturing interests, there were a lot of industrial economic sectors, and just economic sectors writ large that were part of it. Yes, labor was also at the table. Yes, it responded to rank-and-file action, right? So labor and working-class people were key protagonists, but they weren't the only agents of change. Capital was at that, I mean, it was a cross-class coalition, right? And so we could think about that as socialists, you know, what we might think of, you know, would a Green New Deal involve a cross-class coalition? Not. I'll try to come back to that in a moment, but I just want the example in our head. And then let's just go to something more recent, which I think perfectly illustrates this, which is the coalition that won the Inflation Reduction Act, right? In which we, I would not say, were exactly at that table in any way, shape, or form. A few of us may have been in organizations that were indirectly, I'm not sure. But that was very much a deal that was made between like a still very powerful fossil capital, like fossil fuel companies literally signed off on the IRA, and there's reporting on this, it's not like a conspiracy theory. They were fine with it, they got tax credits, and they really didn't like lose from it in any way. So they gave their like rubber stamp to it. Then we have what we might call like green capital, which we could debate whether it exists or whether it's a contradiction in terms, but you know, I'm talking about things like, you know, the EV industry, the battery industry, solar industry, wind, you know, developers. Those people and their lobbyists were at that table, and they wrote sections of that law, right? Then, of course, we have people who are probably not mostly in this room, but who we might be a little closer to on the political spectrum, which is sort of like the mainstream climate advocates, right? Like, these are the big green, they were certainly at the table. I don't want to say we're closer to them, but they're climate people, right? And they don't have a vested economic interest in this. They were there in order to promote decarbonization and climate policy, but in a very mainstream centrist way that we've already kind of discussed. Who wasn't at the table, right? The EJ movement, the environmental justice and the climate justice people were not at the table. Frontline people were not at the table. They really got kind of left out of that. Labor, I would say, was and wasn't at the table in the sense that like labor won some things in terms of like some more tax credits for companies that have like project labor agreement. I mean, there's sort of these very technocratic things that can benefit labor organizing maybe, but they didn't get some of the big demands, which are like these tax credits should only go to unionized workplaces, right? That was a major demand that was in Build Back Better, but got like totally taken out of the final Inflation Reduction Act. So what I'm trying to say without getting too into the weeds, which maybe I'm already a little too in the weeds, is just to paint a picture of what political and economic forces were cobbled together in order to pass, again, what is sadly the biggest climate legislation that we've had in the United States to date. And like, what would it look like for us and a coalition that we are actually a part of to win something of that scale or bigger scale? We can already see that that's like a complicated task because we don't have like powerful economic forces allied with us. We're a lot of groups that are actually marginalized from the conversation. So how would we build a coalition? I think it's clear that like our imagined and in some cases actual practical coalition is the labor movement, community organizations, frontline communities, everyone that we've talked about, you know, youth, like everyone that we've talked about today. And so I think what's most important first and foremost before we can get to a point where that would be a real coalition that could, you know, force legislation through Congress is where do we see internal tensions between those groups or within those groups that is preventing us from having like a really powerful coalition, even if we start as like an outside, you know, kind of like an outside force. We want to be as powerful and unified and internally aligned as possible. Otherwise, we don't really stand a chance of like beating the more powerful forces that are kind of on the other side. So this is something, this issue of kind of like internal tensions and contradictions that unfortunately do pit elements of our desired coalition against one another. That topic is something that we think about a lot. Well, we thought about it a lot in DSA, and I think DSA, eco-socialist and Green New Deal campaigners are still thinking a lot in those terms. At Climate and Community Project, which is a think tank that Johanna and I and some other folks in the audience work with, we really think about where are the people that should be working together, like at counter purposes with one another. I think one place that also in my own work as a researcher, I think about this a lot, is the energy transition and mining.
And what I mean by that, which I see heads nodding, so enough people are kind of aware of what I'm talking about, which is great. I used to have to spend a lot more time explaining that when I said it a few years ago. But what I'm talking about is the fact that all the climate technologies and green technologies that we as socialists want, we want solar farms, we want wind turbines, we want electrified mobility. I won't say we want Teslas, right? But we want e-buses, all this stuff. And all of it requires mining, right? And mining impacts frontline communities. It impacts landscapes. It also generates emissions, like, so it's counter to some of our climate goals, right? So that's a major tension on the political front, the social front, and the ecological front. And so what do we do about that, right? So something that we worked on last year and that I'm tremendously proud of at the Climate and Community Project was a report, and I'm just going to read you the title. I won't even get into it that much because the title says it all, which is Achieving Zero Emissions with More Mobility and Less Mining. And what we found through quantitative empirical analysis was that, in a way, there is a way to have it all if we had the type of, like, social state and policies that would enact this, which is that if we focus on mass transit, on walkability, on affordable density, on all of these land use changes and changes to transportation and how communities are actually constructed, we can get to zero emissions faster, by the way, than, like, the EV model, without as much mining, not with zero, in the near term, maybe in the future with a fully circular economy, but much less mining, like orders of magnitude less mining than would be required with the vision of an EV in every single household, right? And this privatized, individualized model of decarbonized mobility. And so that's a way to not fully square a circle, but to kind of get towards squaring a circle where actually climate advocates and people that advocate for an electrified, renewable economy do not need to be in, you know, total zero-sum tension with frontline communities and people that are conserving landscapes affected by mining, right? And that then seeded a whole bunch of work that goes back to our points about relationship building. So we've visited Nevada, we've built relationships with frontline communities there, we're doing actual political work to kind of make this policy idea feel more real and be something that people can organize around. And so as we're working on that, and this, I'll sort of close out with this idea to not take up too much space, but it relates a lot to what we were talking about with labor, like the next thing that we need to tackle is like, where does labor fit into that, right? Because what I just said sounds like a wonderful vision, except if we produce fewer cars, then we need fewer auto workers. And I'm just saying that bluntly, intentionally, and provocatively, right? And that's not a vision that any auto worker that is right now literally struggling to save jobs that the big three are threatening to lay them off with an excuse that they don't have enough money to electrify their plants and build battery plants unless they lay off workers. So literally our comrades in the UAW right next to me in this room that we're working with and have relationships with are fighting to retain jobs. So how can we get them behind a future of fewer cars when that almost sounds like, it's not exactly what the boss is saying, but it sounds almost like the same, which is fewer jobs for working class people in the auto industry and more deindustrialization in the Rust Belt and destruction of the social fabric there, right? And so that now is beginning, and again, people in this room are folks that we're actively working on this with, a long-term strategy around, like, how can we think of ways, again, not perfectly square the circle, but to have auto workers and battery workers at the front lines of a struggle of a future in which maybe they're building e-buses more than e-Hummers, right? Or like a future in which like something like retooling a factory could be retooled towards something for social need rather than like what the most profitable like big EV is, right? And what would a shorter work week look like in terms of like having enough work to go around that's dignified and well remunerated, but without it depending on the like mass production of vehicles that really aren't actually solving the climate crisis, right? But that means relationships, it means conversations, it means trust. It takes a long time, but I think like we need to just isolate those places and zoom in on those places where there are clear material trade-offs between different constituencies and different struggles and think through like what is the holistic policy platform, not to sound like a wonk, but I think policy is important, but also like political strategy to as much as possible like align the material interests of different constituencies in a kind of eco-socialist vision.
Thank you. So I'm just gonna ask one more question before we go to a Q&A from the audience. So what organizing strategies have possibility right now or durability on the longer term? So I'll go to Brandon for this one.
Yeah, so I'll connect that with some of the thinking that I was doing while Fia was gone, explaining, you know, this framework. Labor, and definitely not the UAW, we were not at the table with the IRA and with ultimately what the plan was for the electric vehicle industry, which was to subsidize the big three and others, but especially the big three, and these joint ventures that they were developing with companies like LG and SK and others to basically subsidize their transition to the future. With no real commitments that they were actually going to do that transition, by the way, and with no real commitments that it was going to be on the timeline that everybody was promoting, right? So what did that mean? What that meant was what happened to Lordstown, which is in 2019, GM shut down the Lordstown assembly plant. 2,000 workers, which meant an entire community dependent on these good union, industry-leading jobs at GM in Ohio, were now out of work, and their communities was going to be shattered. Right. 2 years later, what happens? GM partners with Ultium Cells, right, an LG subsidiary, to develop a battery plant there. Pay at the GM plant was $32 an hour. These same workers, many of them who found jobs within this new battery facility, was $16.50 an hour. Basically cutting 50% pay cut, right, in order to produce the battery cells for these future EV products, right? That is the first thing that Sean Fain told Joe Biden when they met for the first time. It's like, this is it. This is the problem with everything that's happened in this country over the last 30 years, right? It's that this, anything you say that's supposed to be progressive, anything that we're moving towards the future in, and your whole pro-labor posture, and you're letting this happen, right? Because you're promoting this transition in this way. And that's what our strike was about in many ways, right? It wasn't just about COLA and the cost of living and everything else that we wanted in this contract and everything to come. It was about the fact that this so-called transition, right, subsidized now by our government, which was definitely a turn away from a certain kind of neoliberal economic order that preceded it. It was different, but it was still just a corporate handout in order to just basically do away with union labor, right? And that is what we were able to fight back and win back through our contract, right? Was guarantees that Ultium was now going to be in the national agreement. Workers were now going to make $35 an hour, right? So back up and beyond what they were making 4 years ago. By the end of the contract, over $40 an hour, right? The revitalization and rebuilding of that community, and a transition plan for the other companies and the ability to win unions in those companies where facilities are still being built, right? And now we're fighting Stellantis, right? Stellantis did the same thing at Belvedere, right, in Illinois. And they are walking back that promise, those assurances in the contract, right, in writing. And what do they want to do? They don't want to do anything until 2028. Why 2028? Because that's when our contract expires and they can walk back those commitments, right? So what we need to do is have them start putting product back into Belvedere now, build that new EV facility now, and everything else that they committed to doing in Belvedere, right? So, and because we're able to strike a product investment and commitments, right, if they don't follow through, we have real strike power against companies like Stellantis, whose corporate greed is driving them to do these policies that eviscerate working class communities, right? So when we're talking about organizing, right? Yes, there's massive questions to ask about the EV industry. No auto worker is a fan of EVs, right? Because what that means right now is job losses. But that also means that if we're organizing, right, if we're organizing around a future that has a bigger, broader plan about what kind of society we're building, that is how you get unions and the labor movement on board, right? Not every labor union, right? Some labor unions are just as opportunistic as the companies of the workers they represent. But for unions that are building this movement, right, and building towards a vision for a just future, those are the kinds of questions we're going to have to ask. Any democratic or socialist or social democratic government that's ever had to deal with these questions has had to make, different kinds of coalitions. So that question is definitely very interesting to me to think through. But then at the end of the day, I think the only thing that puts you in a position to ask those kinds of questions, right, even at the end when there's some disappointments and some compromises that are made, is the question of power, right? If you're not building power towards that, these are just abstract theoretical questions, right? If you're not building power, but if you are, then that's the best opportunity we have to actually change things.
Thanks for listening. If you like this episode, subscribe to our podcast and to the Haymarket Books YouTube channel, where events like this one are hosted live. And don't forget to check out haymarketbooks.org.